This podcast was recorded on Thursday, March 15th at 12:30 p.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear it.
Yeah, like the Kasich administration may have released another set of job numbers.
Or something else. Who knows? Let's talk Ohio politics.
This is Snollygoster, WOSU's weekly look at Ohio politics. I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown. Coming up later in the podcast, a look at our namesake, Snollygoster. What is it?
This is our first podcast. This is our first episode of Snollygoster. And so let's just run down briefly what we're going to be doing each week. It's a weekly wrap-up on politics. We'll welcome in guests. We have a guest in a moment. We'll introduce her. But we'll have a weekly wrap on politics involving somebody else. Also, weekly interview, Steve?
Yeah, the biggest stories of the week, basically, whether that be guns as it is this week, whatever it is, we'll bring it to you. We'll also have another weekly segment, kind of fun, John Kasich GPS. We'll follow his wandering TV talking head around the country, wherever it might go.
That's right. First to the weekly political roundup, joining us is our colleague, Ann Fisher, host of All Sides with Ann Fisher, 10 to noon weekdays here on 89.7 NPR News. Ann, welcome to the first episode of Snollygoster.
Thank you very much. I'm honored.
Aren't you honored? Yes.
Deeply honored.
I'm glad I don't have to say the name of the show. Go ahead.
And so getting to this week's news, as Mike referenced at the top, the jobs reports, that's plural, job reports issued by the Kasich administration this week, or last week rather.
Yeah, last Friday, our friends over at the Columbus Dispatch, you know, they started this controversy by reporting facts that they were given. They reported figures they got from state officials. Those figures show that Ohio created about 12,000 jobs in all of 2017. That's kind of low. And the Dispatch pointed out that job creation in the last couple of years of John Kasich's administration is lower than the job creation numbers in the last year of Ted Strickland's administration. John Kasich did not like that report.
Yeah, well, their numbers are wrong, so fake news.
Then, a few hours later, the state said it made a mistake and issued new numbers. Ohio actually created 32,000 jobs last year. But here's the thing. Even with those new numbers, Ohio is now creating jobs at a slower pace than it did when Ted Strickland was governor. Steve, this is a big deal because Ted Strickland is the guy who lost 400,000 jobs. Why is John Kasich doing worse?
If you go back and look at the debates from 2010 when Kasich ran against Ted Strickland and was victorious in unseating him, it was jobs, jobs, jobs. It was all about jobs. Regardless of the recession, whatever, however you might want to pin that on Ted Strickland, Kasich made jobs the centerpiece of his campaign. It was very effective. And now he's skirting the issue. He's calling it fake news. He doesn't want a part of this part of the story.
I can't believe he used the phrase fake news. This guy has tried to paint himself as a moderate when it comes to news. I mean, contrasting himself with the president and so forth. And it's kind of shocking when whatever fakery occurred, and it's still unclear what occurred there, came from his own administration.
Yeah, they claim that they had left out a month of jobs figures, and that's why the numbers were different. But, you know, it really comes down to the whole, you know, how much is a politician, a governor, responsible for the state's economy? Because, yes, under Ted Strickland's administration, the state lost 350 to 400,000 jobs. And under John Kasich's administration, now 8 years, the state has gained almost 500,000 jobs. But it depends on when you start the clock. You know, the Cleveland Browns have not lost a game since December. So Ted Strickland lost all of his jobs in the first 3 years of his administration. But the economy was starting to recover in his final year.
It's the same thing that Donald Trump ran on as well. I mean, whatever benefits he might have had in that first year, any logical economist, anybody who follows finances would say, well, a lot of that, you know, someone just doesn't spontaneously create jobs. These are things long time in the making and probably had more to do with the Obama administration. If there's one thing I could do as a political journalist to get rid of, if I could, and I never will, is to get rid of these references references to jobs anyway. It's bogus.
And they both trends of both governors' trends follow national trends. It's not right. it's not like Strickland underperformed. It was at the depths of the recession, and the same goes for Kasich. He hopped on a train that was going uphill. And I'm with Ann as well. The fake news soundbite really jumped out to me. It's so off brand for Kasich, who has really ran against Trump, especially in recent months.
But this goes to the heart of what he's going to, part of what he's going to say when he runs, if he runs for president. Is one, he's a common sense conservative, and two, you know, he pulled Ohio out of the gutter. Well, if Ohio is going back into the gutter with job numbers, that hurts his message.
Right, right.
Not that Ohio is going back into the gutter. We're still better off than we were 8 years ago, but the job growth has flattened.
One of his big accomplishments in office, or at least he would say so, is the creation of Jobs Ohio, the public-private job creation agency that used to be the State Department of Development.
All right. Other news this week. Guns continues to be a big story. This week, Central Ohio high school students joined students from around the country. They walked out of class for 17 minutes to honor the 17 people killed in the Parkland, Florida school shooting and to call on policymakers, lawmakers to do more to stop gun violence.
As students who live on the south side attending South High School, we have been affected by gun violence in our community. We want to show families and friends of the 17 victims who were killed at Stoneman Douglas High School that they are not alone. They will continuously be in our prayers throughout this journey to end gun violence.
Steve Brown, impressive showing. Continued to be an impressive showing by these young people. We saw it first in Florida. Now we're seeing it all around the country.
Yeah, there were, I believe, 23 Central Ohio schools where students participated. Our reporter Nick Evans followed some of the efforts at these schools. It was he did an interesting piece on how this was a crash course in civics and how a lot of these students became first-time organizers. And I think what happened here in Central Ohio certainly reflects what happened around the country. 16, 17, maybe even some middle schoolers. There was some middle mm-hmm. school activity in Bexley as far as organizing around this. It really thrust a lot of teenagers who I'm sure had hoped this would never be an issue. It thrust them into the spotlight, and they gained it. They had a lot of news coverage. Their messaging was effective.
And they're just a few years away from voting themselves. In fact, if you turn 18 before the November election date, you're eligible to vote in the primaries this spring. So this is a harbinger.
Will it have any impact? That's the big question. It's been a month now since the shooting in Florida, and these protests continue. There's another protest set for, I believe, next week, the 24th
right.
of March.
It's already had an impact in Florida. Mm-hmm. Now, people can debate whether, you know, the extent to which Florida lawmakers made anything much different down there. But the fact is that there is a conservative a legislature as the Ohio General Assembly is when it comes to gun issues, and they passed age limits on purchasing guns. That's huge. That's huge.
I mean, they took away, a gun rights person would say they took away the Second Amendment rights for folks who are between 18 and 21.
Right.
That's a big deal for the NRA and, you know, probably for society as a whole.
This has certainly pushed policymakers a little bit. As someone who lives in rural Ohio, I can tell you it has not pushed my neighbors. It has not pushed the average rural quote unquote Trump voter. They are no less prone to own assault weapons than they were 2 months ago.
How do they view these protests? The view from Ridgewood.
In Ridgewood. Honestly, the view from Ridgewood would be, get off my lawn and go back to class. That's serious. That, in all honesty, if I look at my social media feeds from people I went to high school with, people who are my neighbors still, that is largely the view.
Much different than the view from Clintonville.
Much, much different. It could not be more different. I literally live in two different worlds.
But here in Ohio, you know, John Kasich proposed, he didn't propose age limits, but he proposed some very modest proposals. Not one of those is even showing a breath of life mm-hmm. at the State House. They're talking about improving school security. That's all they're talking about at the State House. Donald Trump said that he called out lawmakers for being afraid of the NRA, and then he turned around and pulled a 180 and said, we're not going to do anything either.
So. Right. And whatever he did propose doing, they wouldn't have done anyways. I mean, like I said, the only thing is Florida is a harbinger. And I think that these kids are telling us something. They are energized yeah. by this. They've gotten bitten by the bug. And they are a very, very conscious of the need to, if they want to succeed, to draw it out and have sustainability on it.
And one difference between this and Sandy Hook, where the parents there were extremely passionate, But it didn't really spread from there. It spread among gun control activists, but there weren't parades of preschool age parents walking out of buildings. Here, high school students have formed a kinship with these kids in Florida.
Right.
And it's spreading across the country.
Even then, even with Sandy Hook, it wasn't that long ago, but even then, A, the generation wasn't as into social media. B, the social media is so much more prevalent today, and we have a generation that's already a native to it. So that was a huge factor.
Sandy Hook also had the opposite effect somewhat, in that it boosted gun sales. It boosted what some might call paranoia among the pro-gun crowd. There was another gun rally this week. This one much different, though. Gun rights activists, many of them carrying AR-15s, rifles, shotguns, and handguns, they gathered on the statehouse steps to rebut claims for gun control measures. Among them was Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, who spoke on the statehouse steps while holding a pistol-grip shotgun above her head.
What part of shall not be infringed don't they understand?
All of it.
So here is our message to John Kasich, Mike DeWine, and every other establishment politician. Yeah. Come and take it.
Yeah. And you know, you don't have to listen too hard to hear that might sound somewhat familiar.
From my cold, dead hands.
That's, of course, Charlton Heston speaking before the NRA. Mike, Ann, what is Mary Taylor doing here?
She's trying to distinguish herself the best she can from the front runners in the Republican primary for governor. That's all. That's really all she's trying to do. And she's definitely distinguishing herself. Whether it's a good thing or not is up to the voters.
Yeah, I can understand the strategy. I really can.
Yeah.
I mean, she has to be. You have Mike DeWine and John Husted running against you as your major competitors for governor. Your only choice, really, is to be the Trump Republican. But it just doesn't seem like a natural fit for her. She's been in government a long time. She's not really anti-establishment.
Well,
she's
that's
part of the
establishment question, yeah. But slinging the gun over her shoulder and stuff like that, she's always been very, very conservative.
Yeah.
That feels pretty natural to me. Whether or not it's going to work, I mean, I suppose it's a vulnerability, but I don't think it's as big of a vulnerability for Mike DeWine as she's making it sound like. But she's got to hang her hat wherever she can.
Mike DeWine, we should point out, was not at this rally.
No, he was not.
So, Steve, again, the view from Richwood. How is Mary Taylor going to do out there? She's a lot of Trump Republicans out there. You know, polls show that among Ohio Republicans, Donald Trump still remains popular. I think 75% of Ohio Republicans think he's doing a good job. Is it that unwise, and does she have a chance running as the Trump Republican in rural parts of the state?
I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right, that she would align herself with Trump, that she would push herself away from DeWine and Husted. I think Trump remains popular among my neighbors, if you will. It makes sense for her to go that route. I don't know if any, since we're using the neighbor metaphor repeatedly, I don't know if any of them know who Mary Taylor is. I don't know if non-political insiders really know who Mary Taylor is that much. So she doesn't have that much name recognition still. I guess that does kind of make her the outside candidate in that regard, but I don't think it's effective to this point, I guess I would say, at reaching the common voter.
And that's where the money comes in. I mean, Mike DeWine has got a lot more money than Mary Taylor has.
Well, he's also his lieutenant, you know, his running mate, John.
Name ID is high to begin
Husted,
with.
Husted, right. Yeah. Right. I mean, the name ID is higher. They have more money to reinforce that name ID. Mary Taylor has been out and about for the last, has she been lieutenant governor the whole time? Because she's been out doing ribbon cuttings for 7 years,
yeah.
And she has been around. But I don't know how much of that time has been spent trashing the governor or Mike DeWine and John Husted. So I don't know how much she gained from that.
Yeah, I'll see how it'll be interesting to see how this all turns out. Okay, thanks, Ann Fisher, for joining the political roundtable this week. It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have you back.
I hope so.
All right, Steve, it's time for our weekly segment,
John Kasich GPS.
Governor Kasich, welcome back to Meet the Press.
Thanks, Chuck.
Governor, welcome back to Fox News Sunday.
Rockville, isn't this close to Bethesda?
And we went to Tulsa instead of where we were going in Colorado.
I think I've eaten my way across the entire state of New York.
Ground control to Major Tom. Help me.
Take your protein pill.
John Kasich still remains governor of Ohio, but his eyes seem to be on another prize. We're not exactly sure what that prize is or how he plans to get there, but he sure does a lot of talking about non-Ohio things.
This week, John Kasich's GPS took him to New York City. He was on CNBC Monday talking trade.
And I just think protectionism doesn't work. It costs the consumers money. It means that we don't have the kind of innovation we want. But at the same time, if you're going to cheat me, I got to blow the whistle.
And while he was there, he stopped in on, it was like the 30 Rock stop. He stopped in on MSNBC to react to news that Donald Trump sacked Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
It's certainly unique. I mean, in some ways, it's like a soap opera, you know. The only thing is that I'm not, you know, you turn back on 2 weeks from now if you don't watch it. It's kind of the same thing. It's really amazing.
Then he talked about both in an appearance on The Street, a digital financial news service.
Joining me now at the NASDAQ market site in Times Square is Ohio Governor John Kasich. Governor, it's great to have you back here. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Let's start
off. Next week, he'll go back to California for an event with Arnold Schwarzenegger. All right, now to the name of this podcast. When we went looking for a name for yet another political podcast, we wanted something different, something that stood out. So I just Googled political terms, and there it was, snollygoster.
And it dates back to the 19th century, and it was the subject of a TED Talk given by Mark Forsyth. He's an author and connoisseur of language and the host of the blog The Inky Fool.
One of my favorite words in the whole of the Oxford English Dictionary is snollygoster, just because it sounds so good. And what snollygoster means is a dishonest politician. Although there was a 19th century newspaper editor who defined it rather better when he said, a snollygoster is a fellow who seeks office regardless of party, platform, or principle, and who, when he wins, gets there by the sheer force of monumental talknophical assumnacy.
And joining us now on the phone from London is Mark Forsyth. Mark, good to have you here. That editor to whom you refer wrote for the Columbus Dispatch. What exactly is talknophical assumnancy?
I have absolutely no idea, I'm afraid. Both words are made up. They don't appear in the Oxford English Dictionary anywhere. So they are just sort of joke words. But they sound about right. Talknophical assumancy means you probably do a lot of talking and assuming and ascendancy and things like that, all mashed up into a sort of nonsense couple of words.
As we mentioned, the editor who you referred to and is giving credit in many online searches for the word wrote for our own Columbus Dispatch right here in Columbus. Do you have any idea who the editor was talking about? I did some research, and William McKinley was the governor at the time, Ohio governor at the time.
He was talking about another editor, I'm afraid. So the editor of the Columbus Dispatch said a Georgia editor. He's talking about how the word was used in Georgia and in other parts of the United States. But he's the first person who ever wrote it down that everybody knows of.
So he wasn't poking fun at an Ohio politician or somebody like that. It was an intra-newspaper battle then.
Something like that. Yeah, they always are.
The other word we considered for this podcast was mugwump. And that's a politician who is motivated by the public good, nonpartisan, non-self-motivated, kind of the opposite of snollygoster. In your opinion, are more politicians snollygosters or mugwumps?
Well, mugwump is actually a rather negative word as well. A mugwump usually means somebody who pretends to be above the fight, who pretends to be all neutral and serene and anti. That's also a United States word, by the way, as well. It probably comes from the Wampanoag language, where it means a ruler or a chieftain from the what's now the Massachusetts area of the United States.
Yeah, one reference I saw said a mugwump was someone who fled the Republican Party, which, you know, you could argue that our Governor John Kasich right now could be put into that category. Anyway, you maintain that words are the center of politics. Not policy, not votes, not money, but words. Why are words at the center of politics?
Well, politics is all about debate, and politics is all about persuading people to vote for you, or it certainly is if you are in a democracy. And the way you persuade people to vote for you is using words, using language, and trying to be the most memorable and persuasive user of language. Although I don't think my general view is that people always trying to give a better word for the thing they do. The thing I do is better than the thing you do, so I'm going to give my policies a nice title and your policies a bad title. This is why you have those beautiful irregular political verbs like I invest in infrastructure, you spend money on infrastructure, he wastes the taxpayers' money on infrastructure. I'm a whistleblower, you leak stuff to the press, he betrayed the trust of his colleagues. So we're always trying to change reality by using different words for it. But the thing is that reality has a habit of existing and still existing, whatever we call it. And so reality starts to change words and change the meaning of words. And once you've started using something enough for a different meaning, then the word just changes its meaning.
We live in really interesting political times now with the ascension of Donald Trump and then the recent Brexit vote. Can you provide an example that you think best really shows how political rhetoric changed policy, maybe even changed history?
Yeah, I mean, the classic one in Brexit, which is where I'm from, is the whole question, actually, and also in the Scottish referendum, Scottish independence referendum that preceded it, is the whole question of in a vote which is yes or no, or in or out, how do you phrase that vote? I remember there was a poll which showed that in the Scottish referendum, the Independence Party had a massive advantage because they were the yes campaign, because the question was phrased as, should Scotland leave the United Kingdom, rather than should Scotland stay in the United Kingdom. Therefore, they were able to put up lots of posters saying, say yes, and all these positive messages. Whereas everybody else, the side which wanted Scotland to remain in the United Kingdom, had to put up lots of posters saying no, which is a bad message in the first place. Similarly, in the Brexit debate, you had it came down to a choice between Brexit, which sounds kind of flashy and cool, and the other side was called Remain. And Remain is just, well, it's such a boring word, such an undynamic word, such a... It's hard to get people cheering and shouting and screaming, Remain! And so you lose straight off there when you, just in terms of how you phrase the question.
Yeah, keep things as they are. It doesn't have the same ring to it as move forward. You write about the importance of slogans. You cite in marketing, United, fly the friendly skies, or Walmart, always low prices. Let's take that to politics. How important are political slogans?
Well, I got this completely wrong once. I once gave a speech about American politics, probably shouldn't have done so. And I was only talking about the slogans and the words. And I pointed out that there's a formula which American presidents and presidential candidates love to use, which whereby you just reverse the order of a sentence. So ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, or... mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. It was John F. Kennedy who really started this, but everyone's been doing it since. So Bill Clinton said, people the world over have always been more impressed by the power of our example than by the example of our power. Ron Reagan said, the difference between me and my opponent is I want to check government spending and they want to spend the government checks. And you just ever find these same pattern repeated and repeated and repeated. And so I thought that Donald Trump would never get to the White House unless he could find a slogan like this. but nonetheless, he got to the White House, so that shows how much I know.
He used a lot of slogans, things like Make America Great Again, Build That Wall, Lock Her Up. Asking you, as an entomologist, a connoisseur of language, what do you think of President Trump's political speech, the way he talks?
I think the main thing about Donald Trump, and this actually goes to quite a few other politicians around the Western world, is not the way he talks, but the way he doesn't talk. In the Western world, everyone has a problem with the way machine politicians, as they're called, tend to talk. There's always, in the whole history of language, there's always been a difference between the way people talk in private and the way people talk in public. And that's probably a very good thing. You know, if you're comforting it really is, because
sure.
Think about it. If you're comforting a girl, you know, who's just been dumped by a boyfriend, you can say, "Oh, all men are nasty. Men are awful." Or if you're comforting a guy, you know, who's been dumped by his girlfriend, you can say, "Oh, women, you know, oh, they're But yeah. And that's a fine thing to say in private. But if you stand up in front of a political rally and say, all men are awful, that's when things start to get dangerous. So it is good that there is a difference between public and private discourse. But these days, that difference has become so large that people feel alienated from politics and alienated from politicians. You have these people coming up giving bland speeches. They all talk the same. They all look the same. And so a method for getting yourself noticed and breaking away from all that is just to talk differently, however that difference manifests itself. You can nonetheless say, I'm not like them. Listen to the way I talk. So it doesn't particularly matter what you choose to talk like, as long as it's not like the average politician.
It's like the old thing. They take Donald Trump passionately, just not literally. They like his energy, the people who support him, not necessarily exactly what he is saying, because what he says changes from day to day, week to week, it seems.
It probably does, but he doesn't sound like your standard Washington politician. That's what he's got going for him.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really look like a standard Washington politician either, but people like that as well.
Well, that's the truth. Mark Forsyth, he is an entomologist, a word connoisseur. He is the author of the blog The Inky Fool and author of the book A Short History of Drunkenness. That's a podcast right
there. I thought it would be
right
a long
there.
History.
It is a very long history. It goes all the way back. Ancient Egypt, the way they got drunk there was terrifying, but there we are.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, thanks very much for having me on the show.
And that will do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster. Be sure to tell your friends all about us. You can also listen to 89.7 NPR News on the radio dial. You can find us on the WOSU Public Media mobile app. And you can also ask your smart speaker to play WOSU. Until next week, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson.